Is there an aspiring storyteller inside you? Well, how about putting that storyteller out there, up on stage? You've got a chance here Wednesday after work. Join us anytime between 5:30 and 7 o'clock at the Allen Marketplace in Lansing. Its current state's pop-up stories are June edition. Our storytellers will be telling first-person stories involving putting down roots. 5:30 till 7, Allen Marketplace, east side of Lansing. You can learn everything you need to know on the Current State Facebook page and on the Pop-Up Stories Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Okay, so all the information on Facebook there. We hope you can join us either in a storytelling capacity or in just in a listening capacity. They're always a lot of fun. I'm Mark Bayshore. To begin our program today, the standards for becoming a classroom teacher in the Detroit public schools will be changing soon. Part of Michigan's DPS bailout effectively relaxed teacher certification standards in the district. Advocates for the change, which include Governor Rick Snyder, have been making their case for some years. But others resist the change, including our first two guests today. Dr. Margaret Crocco is the chairperson of the Department of Teacher Education at Michigan State University's College of Education. Welcome, Dr. Crocco.
Good morning, Mark.
And we also welcome Sonia Gunnings-Moten, Assistant Dean of Student Support Services and Recruitment, also at MSU's College of Ed. Welcome, Sonia.
Good morning to you, Mark.
We still have a few details, really, concerning how this will be implemented, but I'd like to hear from both of you here and just talk to us broadly about what you think this means or could mean.
Yeah, I think that it is an unfortunate decision to open the door, even though we don't know as yet whether anyone will act upon this opportunity. But I think it's an unfortunate decision to open the door to the possibility of having non-certified teachers working in DPS. Everything we know from the research about the impact of non-certified teachers would raise many questions about why one wants to go this route. There was research a number of years ago in New York that compared the efficacy of certified to non-certified teachers in that huge New York City school system. And it showed that non-certified teachers were less effective in promoting raising student achievement than certified teachers. And at a time when we want the achievement of all of Michigan's students to be going up, this seems to me an unfortunate move that will harm students of Detroit.
Yeah, Sonia Gunnings-Moten, what do you think?
Well, I concur with everything that Margaret has just said. It would help for us to have a better understanding of what the promotion of the presence of non-certified teachers in Detroit public schools is really expected to respond to or accomplish. And as Margaret has said, we don't have any evidence that would suggest to us that such an effort would result in what we hope is a shared agenda by all, and that is increased educational opportunities and outcomes for Detroit children.
Well, the discussion, one of the discussion's focuses is, is on professional people who've enjoyed careers in the STEM fields, in particular, engineering and the like, the thinking being that there's a lot of those people who could help students in the classroom, on the surface at least. That hardly seems radical. Do you have particular concerns with that?
Yes, I think there is an assumption that's made, Mark, that just because you have deep content knowledge, as certainly engineers would have of their field, that this is adequate preparation for teaching school children. We know that content knowledge is necessary, but we also know that it's not sufficient in terms of efficacy in the classroom and raising student achievement. There are bodies of knowledge, for example, the psychological development of students, the cognitive development of students, that's important. One needs to know something about classroom management. One needs to know something about schools in order to be effective in translating that content knowledge into real educational achievement for children.
Let's work another voice into our conversation here briefly. This is a perspective that seems fairly similar to your own. Let's listen to Michigan Superintendent of Schools Brian Whiston on relaxed teacher certification. This is Superintendent Whiston from last Thursday here on Current State.
The profession of being a teacher is a very noble job, a very difficult job. I mean, you're kind of a nurse, you're a social worker, you're a doctor, you're an educator. There's a lot of different roles you play, and to be successful, you have to play all those roles well. So while I don't support having teachers who are uncertified in the classroom, I do support, you know, a streamlined process to get people who have a passion for kids and a knowledge base to get into the classroom and teach on a quicker basis.
So in the end, he says he is against non-certified classroom teachers, but he appears to accept that this is that this is changing, and he does see a role for certain non-certified educators.
Well, yeah, I would encourage us to get the focus back on what is best for students as opposed to adults. So when I hear the argument that there are those in the business or other sectors who are interested in teaching, of course we find that admirable. But that interest is about their agenda. I'm more concerned about what is in the best interest in meeting the educational outcomes of these students. And so, as Margaret has said, it is about more than the content knowledge in and of itself. And it is more than about just wanting to be engaging with students in the classroom. We are of the position that it requires a professional preparation, pedagogical understanding in order to be effective in that context. So the desire to simply want to teach is in and of itself not sufficient.
Let me bring up another rather delicate point here. This is a district that has struggled mightily for years. Does the need in DPS do anything to justify the plan any further?
If I could just first respond to the question that you'd asked last time and the Brian Whiston comment,
sure.
Because I would point out that we already have a program in place at MSU for fast-tracking individuals in STEM areas into classrooms. It has been sponsored by NSF, by the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. It's part of a national initiative to do the kind of thing that we're talking about here, which is to fast-track individuals who come with the desire to teach, but it puts them into a program, a master's program, that gives them the bodies of knowledge that they need through some acceleration in the summer, and then through a very, very closely monitored and mentored teaching experience throughout the year, ultimately culminating in a master's program. So, you know, I think the tricky thing here is to try to understand more deeply the question of need. Sonia's pointing out, whose need are we talking about? But one of the things that we know, for example, is that there are shortages in DPS in some areas like STEM, but these are shortages that exist across the country. These are shortages, bilingual education, special education, for example, that
they're
exist.
They're not worse in Detroit than they are generally everywhere else?
They may be. I am not sure that they are any worse than exists in most major metropolitan areas, because urban areas are always the hardest to staff. But some of that we could look to questions of what else might explain the fact that there appear to be shortages. One of the things that we know about our MSU grads is that many of them would like to teach in Detroit. However, the calendar for the hiring process in Detroit has been laid in the season than for many other districts around the state and around the country. So effectively what happens is that our students who would be happy and really seek a teaching job in Detroit get offers in March and April and May. And of course they're worried about their student loans, they're worried about having a job. So that in the past, Detroit has tried to hire later. And I'm sure this has contributed to a perceived shortage in teachers in that district, especially in the high needs areas.
And that is the case. In Detroit, my partners in Detroit Public School, just as Margaret has explained, recognize that being an organizational problem and have engaged in efforts just recently to reverse that trend that I think need to be acknowledged. Just this past month, Detroit Public Schools hosted one of a series of teacher fairs with the intent to make early offers. The one last month actually occurred at Martin Luther King High School. There were over 400 mostly certified professionals seeking teaching positions in Detroit Public Schools. DPS, if I understand correctly, made offers to over 100 of them at that fair. So they are readying themselves to address what they know will be perceived shortages for the upcoming academic year. So they too have been aware of the challenges in their timing of offering teaching positions. And we also know from research that when you place individuals in these teaching positions after the school year has started, you also increase the likelihood that they will leave. So we're trying to, and they are trying to, get ahead of that game and have made some significant efforts. So I just offer that to say that there has been a tremendous response by certified educators who have an interest and who have a desire to work in Detroit public schools. But that does not change the challenges that will continue to prevail, that making the decision to open the door for non-certified teachers does not address. That does not address the absence of incentives for high-quality educators to work in these settings. It does not address the challenges of the working conditions under which they must perform and reach high levels of academic achievement.
I know you're troubled by the Detroit focus of
I'm very troubled by that.
This. Talk to us about that.
Well, of course, the question and the conversation that I'm having with those in Detroit is, why is this only Detroit? And I've heard others saying that there may be a plan or anticipation for it to be
others. They want to expand it. Right. Some number of people at the Capitol want to expand it.
And that in and of itself, again, takes me back to the question, so why Detroit? As it is right now, it is just Detroit. And we don't know what or if or how these efforts or this position may expand to others. What we know right now is that it's starting with Detroit. And there is a interesting sort of groundswell of conversation among parents and community members who are asking to be educated because of this sort of conversation, Mark, so this is helpful, who themselves are asking to be educated about what does this mean, who themselves are saying, why has the decision been made that less qualified individuals can teach my children? So in an interesting way, it has opened up and provided an avenue for us to have conversations that we have not been on top of in the past. But yes, parents and community members, fortunately, are asking that question, why this decision and why Detroit?
We are talking with Sonia Gunnings-Moten, Assistant Dean of Student Support Services and Recruitment here from MSU's College of Education. Dr. Margaret Krakow also joins us. She's chairperson of the Department of Teacher Education here at MSU's College of Education as well. We'll point out that we are under the impression here that, and I think one or both of you can confirm this, that Alicia Merriweather, the interim superintendent of DPS, has suggested that even though they are being, encouraged to pursue non-certified teachers, I suppose, or that they will have the authority, that she does not intend to use it. And she's been pretty explicit about that. This gets a little tricky, though, because she does have that interim in front of her name, so we don't know. There's also a new school board on the horizon. Who knows how all of these people are going to feel about this?
Yeah, I think that, one of the things that you've just pointed out in such a nicely encapsulated version is the ambiguity, the lack of stability in this situation. And I would say that this is not in the best interests of DPS to be in such an ambiguous, unstable situation. I think that we would like to see, as Sonia's pointing out, ways of dealing with Detroit that are analogous or the equivalent to the ways in which we deal with the rest of the state of Michigan, which is to hold teachers to a high standard, to insist that we have certified teachers. You know, one of the things, interestingly, we know, even with the what may be perceived from the outside as significant turnover and change of a negative sort in Detroit, is that the average teacher working in Detroit has a tenure of somewhere between 14 and 15 years. You know, this shows a significant amount of commitment on the part of Detroit's teaching force for the children of Detroit. And I know from my own research with former students that what they are looking for, whether they're teaching in New York or in any place in Michigan, is that they want stability. They want to, as anyone might expect, know what the future holds. So this situation is very damaging.
In the limited time we have left, let me introduce what you might consider a cynical viewpoint, but I want to put it out there. Some number of our listeners are hearing this and may well be thinking, well, of course, a college of education whose bread is buttered by students pursuing teaching degrees and certificates, of course they're going to make a case for more stringent standards. A cynical view, perhaps, in your view, but how do you respond to someone who is thinking that?
I think we have the expertise in colleges of education because this is our life, this is our profession. We do a lot of research on these questions. And if that leads us to a position that makes a claim that based on that research, we think that every teacher should go through a program like ours or the other many fine programs of teacher certification throughout the state, it's based in research rather than in being self-serving.
I would agree with that. I would say that that those cynics are right. We do have a position about this based upon what we know, based upon what we understand, and based upon what we've experienced. So we are not taking this position only because we're a college of education. We're taking this as a position as a very informed college of education.
We want to thank our guests, Sonia Gunnings Moten, Assistant Dean of Student Support Services and Recruitment at MSU's College of Education. Dr. Margaret Crocco is chairperson of the Department of Teacher Education, also at MSU's COE. Of course, as we've learned, the DPS will be relaxing its standards regarding certification of classroom teachers. Not clear how that's going to unfold, but we have dealt with it here this morning. We hope it was constructive. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, city attorney nominee Jim Smirtka of the Lansing city attorney nominee joins us to talk about the problems facing the Lansing City Council and how he could play a part in solving them as the next city attorney. That's on the way on Current State. In Detroit, there are neighborhoods where most of the houses have been demolished, along with knocking down long empty houses that are beyond repair. The city's been encouraging people to buy homes with an eye on making those parts of the city livable again. One couple decided to move from Brooklyn, New York, into an old Detroit house a few years ago. The project's become the subject of a book in Current State. Scott Pohl checked it out. The author teaches journalism here at MSU. Scott, right?
That's right, Mark. Amy Heimerl is the author of Detroit Hustle, a memoir of life, love, and home. This house was once owned by Arthur and Nona Herzog. He wrote God Bless the Child for Billie Holiday. Those were probably its best days. The home had been empty, save for occasional squatters, for about a decade, and it was falling apart. Amy Heimerl, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me. It's exciting to be here.
Well, here we are in Detroit in front of your home. And my first question for you is, as we stand outside your home, to tell me what your reaction was the first time you stood in this spot.
Well, the first time I stood in this spot looking at it, the house was completely boarded up and we had no idea what we were going to be walking into. It was a little overwhelming, and we would walk into a house that had no heating, no plumbing, no electrical. Basically needed to be completely rebuilt inside the existing walls. But when I stood back outside after finally touring the inside and seeing the devastation, I already knew I was in love.
See, lots of people would look at that and go, what have I done?
I think there were definitely moments once we bought the house where that was true. But at that time, standing out sort of in a spring bluster, a street light comes on, this giant white tomcat walks across the roof, and it just felt like all the signs were pointing toward home.
Why did a white tomcat tell you that you were home?
I don't know. It feels like I was just looking for signs. I think I just read Under the Tuscan Sun by Frances Mays, and she was looking for signs too, so maybe I'd been influenced.
Did your husband share this?
Yeah, so he saw the Tomcat, and he actually saw me out here standing and talking to the house that he named Matilda, saying, tell me if this is, you know, do you want me to live here? Do you want us to do that? If so, say something now, and then the streetlight comes on, and he was just shaking his head, being like, there goes my wife.
Now, I know you call the house Matilda. Why do you call the house Matilda?
My husband, Carl, named the house that after the Tom Waits song, Waltzing Matilda, about sort of an aging old, you know, woman who had great bones and great beauty, that, you know, he saw that in this house.
All right, well, let's describe the house. I see two floors and maybe an attic, sort of a third floor with some windows, red brick, and you've mentioned the devastation inside, and we'll learn more about that when we go in. What kind of shape was the outside in when you arrived here?
So mostly just like this. What we've had to fix on the exterior has been windows. So those were all boarded over. Now we actually have windows. And the roof had to be completely repaired. And sort of the roof line, one of the things we learned about was dentils, which if you look up at a lot of historic homes, they're the little square boxes at the roof line. We have 100 of them, and they all had to be recut out of cedar. Those are things you don't think about when you buy one of these properties.
Oh, my. Well, I'll tell you what. We will get lots of pictures and show them at WKAR.org for people who follow along with us. Let's go on inside. All right, here we are in your entryway, Amy. Tell me about this part of the house.
So this part of the house, we actually couldn't enter when we first bought it because the front door was sealed shut. Somebody had beaten apart the front door and then nailed it shut. So we didn't even have a door. We had to go through the back. All of this didn't have doors. We're standing in front of what is now a bathroom. Our contractors added that in. Historic trim out of a church. There was almost no original detail left to this historic house. But a church was scheduled for demolition here in Detroit, and we were able to get a lot of the wood and doors out of it. So what you're looking at right now is all that amazing historic woodwork out of an old 1880s church. So if you come through here, we're looking over to the left in what had been the coat closet and now is a built-in bookshelves. My contractor, Cal Garfield, and I both love books. And so one of the things he wanted to do in renovating this house is bring in a lot of bookshelves. And so this had water running through it. It was moldy. It was falling off the side of the house. And he's restored it and made it gorgeous built-in bookshelves that I'm very excited about. In this room, we have the kitchen and the dining room. This was originally about 5 small rooms. I couldn't even figure out where a refrigerator would go. So one of the few changes we made to the footprint of the house was opening up this space so we could really use it in the modern way with people gathering around this 9-foot island we have. We have a lot of parties in here and people love to just hang in this space. Off of the kitchen, you see a sunroom where my husband's grand piano is. When we bought the house again, that was not going to be salvaged. It was so far gone. Again, water running through it, mold falling off the side of the house. The entire south wall actually was collapsing. So we had to rebuild the south wall. But in doing that, our contractors figured out a way to save the sun porch. And so now my husband's piano is in there and he gets to play.
You've mentioned on more than one occasion here now things that were really, really in bad shape or falling away from the house. Did anything ever actually have to be fully removed from the house in that regard, or were you able to salvage everything?
We were able to salvage everything. That was not something we expected, but in the process, we, you know, didn't actually lose anything.
This looks like a living room area.
This is the living room. So when we first saw this room, we actually couldn't see anything because it was boarded up. You know, it was just dark. I always thought this room was going to sort of be a dark den once we got it done. And then the windows came in, and it was a little shocking how much light was let in and how close to the street we were. So that was a beautiful surprise. The fireplace still needs to be redone. At some point it got singed, so you can see that it's black and needs some work, but that's in process. So I'd say the house is about 95% done, still some details to work on.
All right, so you wrote a book when the housework wasn't quite done yet.
Right, not quite done, but we're at the point where it's like painting, redoing the fireplace, just sort of small cosmetic things. Then we go upstairs. There was a bathroom, which we can look now. It's one of the few places where original detail, the floor, was able to save. But where the bathtub was actually was a giant hole to the basement. So there wasn't actually any plumbing. There wasn't a bathtub. There wasn't a toilet. There wasn't a sink anywhere in the house. So all of that had to be redone. All the fixtures had to be put in. We have a master suite. And so this is right above the kitchen. So just like we opened up the kitchen and dining room, this was also a warren of a bunch of tiny little rooms, including another kitchen and a bathroom. So we opened that up into a master suite. So those are the two big differences. And then above my husband's piano room, I have my work room.
We're talking with Amy Heimerl. Her new book is Detroit Hustle, A Memoir of Life, Love, and Home. Well, you have created a beautiful home, lots of natural lighting. We have to talk about a few things like the money involved.
Sure.
Let's start with what you paid for the house.
So we bought it in early 2013 for $35,000. So, and it is a 3,000 square foot brick home in a historic district that is actually on the National Register of Historic Places. So there's many neighborhoods in Detroit where you could buy something cheaper even than that. Most things still require a lot of work, just like this house. I think the price point at 35 was a little higher because of sort of being in a stable neighborhood like the West Village.
So you paid $35,000 for the house. Mm-hmm. Do you mind telling me how much more you have now spent on these renovations?
Sure. The total renovation cost has been about $400,000, which sounds like a lot. But if you were buying a house like this in any city in America, $400,000 would be a pretty stable fair market value. The challenge is, of course, that it's hard to get loans for that kind of money on a house that you buy for $35,000. The bank isn't inclined to give you loans. Fewer than 10% of homes in Detroit get mortgages. Most sales are all cash, and then the renovations are all cash.
I assume you've gotten to know your neighbors. I would be curious to know what your neighbors say about this house and the work you've had done on it.
They are so supportive and so thrilled, even when we had generators running from sunup to sundown for a year and a half because there was no electrical with which to use the power tools. They were thrilled to have the noise because it meant finally the house was coming back to life. You know, they were tired of having to mow the lawns and board it up and try to prevent squatters. So for them, it's been a huge just relief and to have us here and have this house brought back to life. We did a historic restoration, not just a Home Depot special renovation. We tried to rebuild this house for another 100 years. When we did get the appraised value on it, it was $300,000. So some people are concerned that we're $100,000 underwater. I look at it as in Brooklyn, we could never have afforded to buy. So by coming here, we got an amazing house, an amazing community, and our monthly carrying costs are still lower than they were there. So we come out ahead and we're not trying to flip or sell this house. We're trying to live here until we're too old to make the stairs.
Amy Heimerl teaches journalism at Michigan State University, and she's the author of Detroit Hustle, A Memoir of Life, Love, and Home. Amy, thank you. Great meeting you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up on Current State, is it a golf cart? Is it a skateboard? It's kind of both. It's golf boarding. Current State's Scott Pohl takes us for a spin around the Polo Fields Golf and Country Club near Ann Arbor. That and more after the break.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own.
Well, I mentioned our pop-up stories event Wednesday evening here just a few minutes ago. I am now told we have 13 storytellers lined up for the pop-up stories event Wednesday evening, 5:30 till 7 at the Allen Marketplace. We hope you can join us. The theme for our storytellers is putting down roots. Allen Marketplace, Wednesday, 5:30 p.m. News out of Lansing City Hall has been anything but dull lately, with the city council at odds with the mayor's office on a variety of issues, but it looks like they may be able to agree on one thing. Or at least one person. Jim Smirtko was nominated by Mayor Virge Bernero to be the next Lansing City Attorney. It's expected the City Council will confirm his appointment tonight. Mr. Smirtko would follow interim City Attorney Joseph Abood and former City Attorney Janine McIntyre. He joins us in Studio S this morning. Jim Smirtko, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark, for having me. I appreciate being here.
Sure.
You've expressed the view that part of the city attorney's role is to help the mayor's office and the council work together better. How do you envision doing that, especially in light of some of the recent tension?
Well, first of all, in Lansing, you have a situation in the charter where you don't find usually in Michigan cities where the city attorney actually has a reporting responsibility to the mayor on the executive side, but also to the city council and the legislative side. So it becomes difficult when there's tension between the two branches of government. I have 10 years of working in that type of a tense atmosphere. So I'm going to bring the experience and knowledge of the past and hopefully a great measure of wisdom in dealing with that to try to find solutions that are acceptable to both sides of the branch of government.
Do you think Mayor Bernero, as well as the members of council, would appreciate some improvement in that area?
Well, I think anything that moves the city forward. I know the mayor is interested in neighborhoods. Council is interested in neighborhoods. Mayor's interested in economic development. Council's interested in economic development. I'm interested in both those. Our law department's going to be a protector of the neighborhoods, but it's also going to be an advisor for economic development and to assist LEAP and the other organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, whom I've already met with, and help them in their economic development. But again, we will be the protector of the neighborhoods, the law department.
One pretty intense discussion recently involves a predecessor of yours, a former city attorney, Janine McIntyre, and the rather mysterious payout to her when she left the city recently. Emails between Ms. McIntyre and Mayor Bernero and other city officials were just released on Friday to the Lansing State Journal in response to a Freedom of Information Act request sent to the city attorney's office several months ago. The emails have raised it puts more information out there, but in a way, it begs more questions. How involved do you expect to be getting in this matter?
Yeah, I will have to be involved, and I purposely stayed out of that discussion up to this point. I'm not the attorney for the city, so I'm not able to keep any of that protected under attorney-client privilege if there isn't anything. I don't want to know until I'm confirmed. I will be involved, but I'll tell you the major issues go beyond that. If you want an understanding of the city attorney's office and the law department, you have to understand that it not only represents and advises the city council and the mayor, but all of the department heads and the community members. It has all of the agencies that are outside of city government. Mm-hmm. It defends lawsuits that are brought against the city. It is a massive undertaking. And so I've got all these critical issues that I'm facing. I had the staff at the law department last week put together a list of critical issues, and there were no less than 20 on that list. And right now the resources, the human resources in the city attorney's office are thin. The turnover has been great, and I'm trying to figure out, meeting with all the city attorneys there, what do they do best individually, and what do they like to do? And then we're going to have to beef up that staff, and we're going to have to put people in areas that they do the best in. There's been a massive battering publicity-wise against the city attorney's office, so there's clearly the people are motivated, but they're working under this aura of suspicion, so we have to change all that.
So interim city attorney Joe Abood said in a letter that some of the emails sought by the FOIA request that I mentioned a minute ago are not being disclosed to the public because of attorney-client privilege. You referred to that as well. Could your standard of attorney-client privilege differ from Mr. Abood's? I mean, could that change?
It's a case-by-case.
Should that change?
It's too early for me to say, because I haven't looked at what the responses have been. FOIA is a huge issue. FOIA is Freedom of Information Act. Has many requirements in it, has many exceptions in it. Protection of individuals, protection of police procedures. I'd have to look at what the decisions were. But yes, there are some areas of the Freedom of Information Act which require a balancing test, also require a judgment test. And so I will look at that. I'm looking at the volume of Freedom of Information requests that are coming into the city and the police department, and they're ranging between 300 to 600 a month. This is a massive request flow. And so some of these issues, when I look at them and I look at people complaining that the FOIAs, the Freedom of Information requests, are not being fulfilled, I can see just from the volume of it that there may be issues. But yes, I will look at all the decisions and look at going forward what test we're applying in the law department.
Well, you alluded to a lot of the vacant positions in the attorney's office,
right,
as well. Presumably, filling those positions could speed up the FOIA process. Do
I've
you
already
think
started
that could
that.
Happen?
I've already started that. I met with Human Resources last Friday, and they are processing two new attorney positions. A legal specialist. There is no support for in-house litigation for a paralegal. So, and I'm also looking at another utility person to bring, and I want to get that department up to speed staff-wise. We have a credibility issue. That's just because of all the stories, and it's going to get fixed.
Janine McIntyre also functioned for a while as the head of HR. Is that a scenario you'd ever expect to find yourself in?
I have been in that scenario in the past, working for a financial institution. What happens is a lot of times lawyers are recognized because of their analytical methodology, recognized by CEOs as being able to come in and troubleshoot areas. I was general counsel for a financial institution. I also served as personnel director for 3 months, marketing director for another 3 months, ran some brands. You know, you get picked because of that technical knowledge, because of the legal background, and because of the analytical methodology that you employ. So I'm not surprised, but I have no desire to run the personnel department. There's too much here with the city attorney's office to be distracted by other areas.
Be the head of HR as well. Some number of the emails that were released on Friday had redactions in them of names of people in there. Could you comment on that? Would you expect that you might redact less information in the future, for
example? It is quite possible. You have to, if you recall, I started in Lansing after about 20-plus years in other cities as a deputy city attorney or assistant city attorney. And I started with Dave Hollister, who was the author of the Freedom of Information Act and the Open Meetings Act. So I spent 10 years with that background. It's openness unless there's a good reason not to. So there are exceptions in the Freedom of Information Act to protect individuals, to protect police, and we'll look at that. But the main focus is openness and fairness.
Jim Smirka is our guest. Jim is expected to be confirmed tonight by the Lansing City Council as the city of Lansing's next attorney. Another conflict that we've been following is the HUD investigation into whether a recent council decision not to grant an incentive to a developer essentially is discriminatory. The mayor seems to think so. What do you think the best way forward here is?
Well, first of all, the issue of the HUD investigation arises out of a situation that is really not new. It's the program of payment in lieu of taxes, also known as pilots. And there is always a tension in municipalities about taking dollars from tax structures to infrastructure needs, roads, water and sewer, different types of support, police and fire, taking that money and really using it for these pilots. So, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with pilot, but there's a balancing that has to be done. This is not a new issue. This investigation, obviously, the first one, it's on the critical needs list, and I will make contact with the appropriate officials to see where that is and see what we can do. We will defend the council. We will defend the city.
We had a lot more, good many more topics here we wanted to bring up with you today. Those are going to have to wait for another visit. I hope we can have you back soon, and we wish you luck tonight here.
Thank you.
With regard to the vote, we want to thank Jim Smirka, who's been appointed to become the City of Lansing's next city attorney. Thanks for being here. Well, you've heard of surfing, and you've heard of skateboarding, you've heard of snowboarding. Maybe you've even tried one of them or all of them. But not many people have heard of golf boarding. Golf boarding is a new phenomenon in golf. Rather than walking or using a golf cart, golfers step onto a motorized skateboard-like device to get around the course. It looks like a cross between an oversized skateboard and a Segway. When current state Scott Pohl checked it out last year, only one golf course in Michigan was offering golf boarding. He went to Ann Arbor to check it out.
I'm at the Polo Fields Golf and Country Club near Ann Arbor to learn about the first golf boards in Michigan. Members of the club have been invited to a demonstration led by John Kensley, director of golf here and at a sister course in Ypsilanti.
We're just going to take off down the middle of number one, kind of head over by the bunker. We'll make a big soft U-turn and head on back. And this is where you see where this really is a lot of fun and very easy because you're not doing much now.
Part of Kensley's message to these folks is to not be intimidated by the golf boards, not even if you've never been on a skateboard. Operation is pretty simple. You put your bag of clubs on a small rack in front of you, and there's even a drink holder built into the Segway-like handle. The handle is really just to hold on to. You put one foot in front of the other and lean forward to turn right or lean back to turn left. It's designed to prevent jackrabbit starts and sudden stops. I drove one around for a while and couldn't tip it over, zipping around the course in no time. John Kensley.
They're much easier to operate than a lot of people might think when they first look at them. But when you add that to approximately 40 pounds with a full set of golf clubs, it's even that much easier. So it's very easy to work your way around the golf course. And I took it out and made sure that we didn't have any real challenging areas. And there wasn't any area that you couldn't get around with the maneuverability of the golf board.
Now, you have two courses, and I understand you've decided not to have these at the other course. Can you explain why?
Well, we have a little winding creek that goes through the golf course in Ypsilanti. And that golf course, the way that the bridges have been designed, have a pretty severe slope leading up to the bridge and coming off the bridge. There's just not quite enough clearance with regards to the steepness and the clearance of the golf board to go over that.
Yes.
So at some point, we may actually reconfigure those bridges to allow that to happen. But at this point, while we're still making sure that our decision was a good one to bring these on board, this is the facility that's best for that to happen at. And this is a little bit flatter facility. The great thing about these boards is a number of our members found out today is you can take them up and down very severe hills without any problem. But it still takes a while to feel comfortable that you can do that. And we definitely have more hilly terrain over at the Ypsilanti Golf Course.
What do you think this is going to bring to the course in terms of attracting new members maybe? What sorts of benefits might you as a business gain from having these here?
It's a great question. I actually think having the golf boards is something that would tremendously move the needle at a daily fee. I think you get some people that aren't really sure if they want to play golf, and now they see that and say, hey, that's going to be a lot of fun. For a private course, you're more, did you make a commitment to wanting to be a part of a club? But I think when you look at if you're looking to be a member at a club and you look at all the different options that are out there and so on, one of the things you look at is this club progressive? What kind of things are they doing? And I think this is the kind of thing where you look and say, that's a club that isn't stuffy, still understands the traditions of this great game, but is willing to do some different things and so on. I think as we're talking with some of our members, I think what you might see is some of that more occasional golfer that might play 6 or 8 rounds might now play 10 or 12. So I think there'll be a business uptick for us because of it. But ultimately, I think it's just more the atmosphere and the culture that we're trying to demonstrate to our members and our future members.
My name's Justin McNeil. I'm the golf board rep for the state of Michigan.
Give me your elevator pitch for why a golfer would want to use one of these.
I think the biggest thing is if you're going to spend 4 hours of your time these days doing any activity, that it has to be something you really love, and the game of golf has needed something to help excite the sport a little bit, and the golf board I think does that, because not only are you playing golf, you get to do something active and have fun riding the course, doing some great turns. So I think people are going to like that, and otherwise they're saying that you can get around the course in 2.5 to 3 hours as opposed to the normal 4.5-5 hour round, because now you're going to your own ball as opposed to following everyone else.
Alrighty. And they're fun to use.
They are. We just did a demo here, and everyone came off and loved it. what we find at Golf Board is that people who use the Golf Board will return to use it 90% of the time. So I get a call usually once or twice a week from folks in Utah or California who have ridden it out there, who are asking where can they ride the Golf Board here in Michigan.
Golfers may someday choose the course they're going to play at based on whether they can use a Golf Board when they get there.
I really think
Wouldn't
that's
that
the case. I really think that's the case. I think this is something that people are now seeing and asking, you know, what is that? And I really do think courses can differentiate themselves by having this at their facility. It's easier than it looks. The other big thing I notice is that the demographic who uses the board, one common misconception is that it's only for young people. And the guys who call me and email me looking for personal use boards are 40 to 60 years old. And it's actually a lot of the older demographic who loves using it. And the board's easy enough to use that you really don't have to be a surfer or any much athletic ability at all. You can just go and ride the board and have a good time.
The people here to try out golf boarding seem to think it could be a fun alternative to using a cart.
My name is Janine Collins.
What appealed to you about coming out for this demonstration?
They just looked fun. I saw a video that the club had posted, and I had a look at it. And of course, they've been talking about it for a while, and yeah, just thought it would be fun and wanted to have a look.
What did you think?
I thought it was fun. easier than I thought. I think with a little bit of practice, you get a little bit more comfortable and looser, and it would be even better. But yeah, definitely fun.
My name is Richard Scott. I've been a member here at the Polo Fields for I don't know how many years, but I've got a very low number, so I was early on.
What did you think of this demonstration?
We were introduced to the concept through the video that we were all required to watch, which was very helpful. And then we were actually kind of excited to get out here and try these. And we weren't disappointed. I think my wife and I both enjoyed the experience. I've reserved one for tomorrow for a round of golf, and I can't wait to get out and try it. They're very user-friendly. I was a little worried about, you know, being able to handle it. Am I going to fall off of this thing? But actually, after just a few minutes, I think the danger will be not to get too confident too quickly. So I'm going to just go slow tomorrow.
I'm Diane Heiss.
And you're also a member here?
I've been a member for about, I'd say, 12 years now.
Were you ever a surfer, skateboarder, snowboarder before trying this today?
Not a snowboarder, but I did a lot of skiing, so I was really anticipating something a little bit different. And boy, this was great. It was really fun to get on that board and move around.
Were you someone who approached this opportunity to try it with some trepidation, or were you really looking forward to it coming out here today?
Well, I really wanted to try it, but I also didn't want to embarrass myself by falling off. And I'm very happy to say I wasn't going to fall off. I felt very secure, very safe.
Golf boarding looks like a lot of fun, but it is different from walking or riding a cart. I'd speculate that all the leaning forward and backward to steer it will amount to a core workout that many golfers aren't used to. I also felt it in my arms, but that's due in part to the natural inclination to pull the handle to steer, even though that doesn't really steer it. That might go away once you're fully used to shifting your weight to steer. It won't be for everybody. Can golf boarding attract people who have never set foot on a golf course? Proponents hope that it might draw new and younger players to the game. Maybe today's snowboarders, shredding mountains of snow, will be tomorrow's golf boarders, zipping around America's courses. From the Polo Fields Golf and Country Club near Ann Arbor, this is Scott Pohl for Current State.
Along with the Polo Fields Golf and Country Club, a few other courses in the state now have golf boards. They include the Boyne Highlands Resort in Harbor Springs, Egypt Valley Country Club in Ada, and the Fenton Farms Golf Club in Fenton has ordered golf boards and hopes for delivery in the next few weeks. That wraps up our program here on Monday for Current State. Coming up tomorrow, potluck dinners are a common sight in Christian churches across America. A new church in Lansing is taking potluck to a whole new level. The First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason held its inaugural service over the weekend. Its members say marijuana helps them connect on a deeper spiritual level. Critics say it's a dangerous presence that's only out to make money. So which prophet is the church following? We will try to get some answers tomorrow. Plus, we'll attend the retirement party of Maestro Carolyn Sherrill. After 26 years with the Meridian Concert Band, she'll be retiring next month after her a few final Independence Day concerts across mid-Michigan. I will also be speaking with a Michigan State University bee expert about their latest findings here as far as beefing up the chances for pollinators here, very important to fruit, vegetable, and nut crops here all across the country. There are MSU researchers that are involved in that. We will have a discussion involving bees and pollination tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable. It's all about what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond, from politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, government, science and tech, music and theater. It's all there, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, pop-up stories Wednesday evening, 5:30 till 7 at the Allen Marketplace. 13 storytellers are lined up to tell their true first-person stories. Our theme is putting down roots. We hope you can join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.